Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. Today, much like yesterday, is going to be a morph between a podcast and an audio article. I'm picking up on the theme yesterday. Yesterday's episode was Myths of Highways and the Morality of the State. And today's episode is going to be corporate and state slavery. I want to start where I left off on yesterday's podcast. I made the somewhat radical statement that state highway labor is actually slave labor. Now, what I intend to show in this podcast, maybe even a little bit more radical than that statement. First, let's cover the 9 stages of what Robert Nozick called the tale of the slave. Stage 1. You are a slave owned by a brutal master who makes you work whenever he wants, doing whatever he wants, and he beats you whenever he takes the fancy to do so. Stage 2. Things improve, and the master only beats you when you break a rule, and he gives you some free time every week or so to do as you wish, so long as you don't try to leave. Stage 3. You are one of several slaves owned by the same master. He tries to distribute the work evenly among you, and he now allows his slaves to own some things as he sees fit. Stage 4. Nothing has changed from number 3 above, except now each slave is only required to work 3 days a week, and on his off days he can do as he wishes, even to the point of earning money through other work, so long as he doesn't try to leave. Stage 5. The master now allows his slaves to work where they wish, so long as they pay him their earnings for 3 days of the week, or 3/7 of their weekly salary. However, the master does reserve the right to return any or all of his slaves to previous levels of salary in case of an emergency. Stage 6. The master now has thousands of slaves, and he grants them all, except you, the right to vote on who does what work and who owns what. Basically, you now have thousands of masters rather than one. Stage 7. You are granted the right to try to persuade the thousands of other slaves to make decisions more favorable to you, but you still have no actual vote. Stage 8. You can now vote. However, you can only vote if a tie occurs, and a tie has never occurred. Stage 9. You can now vote like the others, except functionally your vote still doesn't really matter unless there is a tie, which has never happened. Now, Nozick asks the question, at what point did this become something other than the tale of a slave? So then, a person living in any location in the world where he must pay his master a set amount of his earnings, and the master can decide what he may and may not own, and whether or not he may come and go as he pleases, is a slave no matter the title we place upon the master. And granting the slave the opportunity to vote doesn't change his status as a slave. At this point, you may be asking yourself what this has to do with corporations. Well, let's go off the track slightly. Economists tend to confuse the discussion of corporations by lumping them all under one term they call the firm. This is as confusing and misleading as lumping the functions of government under the heading of the state. I've said before that some, if not most, functions of the government are legitimate until the state usurps them and introduces aggressive force. For example, who would argue that mail service is not an honest pursuit? And yet, when the state moves in with its forced monopoly and prevents competition while dictating prices and levels of service, mail is no longer a legitimate business. It's simply another tentacle of the state. And the same goes for fire, ambulance services, police service, or road construction. Remember, it's not about individual aspects of the state. It's about the principle of voluntary interaction rather than force and coercion. The same is the case when we talk about a corporation, or, if you prefer, a firm. The manufacturing of shoes is a legitimate pursuit until the corporation chooses to lobby the state to restrict competition through regulations and wage controls or other socialist methods. Then the corporation simply becomes a part of the state. Adam Smith praised the firm by comparing it to the concept of the division of labor And his comparison stood until Mises clarified the point some 200 years later. Mises convincingly stated that the division of labor stems from diversity and inequality of human beings and of nature. In other words, the division of labor is spontaneous when humans are left to freely interact. Factors such as individual desires, individual talents, individual interests, and available resources drive different people into different production classifications. However, in the modern corporate setting, the division of labor is anything but spontaneous or natural. It's a matter of top-down planning, as in the socialist method. Consider how a small company operates as opposed to a large corporation. One, you are interviewed for employment at Bill's machine shop. Bill asks you what your experiences are and where your talents reside. Now, at this point, you're interviewing with Bill. Bill might find out that you're better at sweeping the floor than, say, precision machine operation. So he would, if he's going to hire you, he's going to try to put you into a position where sweeping the floor and jobs like that are a part of what you do. If, on the other hand, Bill sees within you the ability, or maybe you get hired at that, and then 6 months down the road, Bill sees within you the ability to really become a good machinist. In a small company setting like that, Bill can quickly adapt his workforce and shift you into a position where your talents and your skills can be utilized better. Maybe you work there 6 months and Bill sees that, no, you're pretty much a floor sweeper and that's what you're always going to be. Well, there's still a spot for a floor sweeper. There's no reason why Bill can't use you in that capacity as long as there's a spot, as long as they have floors that need to be swept. On the other hand, at any particular time in the small company like that, your individual talents and your individual desires and your individual interests can bring you into a niche within Bill's company so that you can perform at a much higher capacity than you could if Bill had just pointed at you and said, you're the floor sweeper, and that's the end of that. Now, let's go to number two. Number two is a large corporation. Okay, you're interviewed by a job placement service on behalf of a large corporation. They want to see your resume, they have you fill out an application, it's very specific, what's your education, where did you live prior to this, let's find out what your credit rating is. There's all these stages that they go through to classify you. And when they get all done classifying you, if there's a spot within the corporation that they can fit you, whether or not it's suitable to your talents is not the question. If there's a spot within the corporation that they can fit you, then you're stuck into that spot. Once you're in that spot in the corporation, trying to move into something different is possibly difficult at best. Whether or not any movements within the corporation are based on your own desires, your own talents, and your own interests, not very likely. It's more likely it's going to be how politically motivated you are within the company, how well you get along with your boss and your boss's boss, and whether or not you can kiss up to them in such a way that you can impress them and yet not threaten them. That's a key in the corporation. If you're working in a corporation and you're hoping to improve your position, get better wages, get into a better job opportunity and so forth, one of the key things you have to do is do a lot of your boss's work for him without ever threatening him. If you ever show the possibility that you might be smarter, more talented, more aggressive than your boss, the odds are he's going to shuffle you downward to a lesser position because he's going to be threatened by you and he's not going to want you on a peer level with him. Therefore, there's this mechanism built in the corporation that always drives the worst to the top. Whereas if we saw in example one with Bill's machine shop, there's always a mechanism to find what your niche is and for you to be able to exploit your own talents and your own skills to the highest point possible. And Bill is generally willing to reward you for those efforts and never feel threatened by you because he owns the company. You can never overcome Bill's position because he's the boss, and he's always going to look for a way to bring the brightest and the best up towards the top within his small company. This doesn't exist in corporations. Just the opposite exists. Because the corporation is based on the socialist model, of central planning. Committees decide everything. In the corporate setting, they may have a variety of names rather than calling it a committee, or rather than calling it a Senate or a Congress or something like that. But it's basically the same thing. You have a group of people making the decision. They might call it a round table. They might call it a committee. They might call it, they may call it an action group. They may call it teamwork. They may have any variety of names that they want to lather upon it. But it doesn't matter. What it basically is a socialist top-down committee deciding upon the structure of labor and upon the distribution of that labor. So from its very construction, the corporation is tainted by this socialist model. Therefore, the corporation can never compete with the private business on a level playing field. And what do I mean by a level playing field? Not what the government calls a level playing field. A level playing field is where the state doesn't get involved. Where the state doesn't get involved, the corporation will naturally, or the firm, if you prefer that for the economists listening, the corporation will naturally grow to a size that it becomes self-destructive. And at that point, the private company will always win out in the battle between the two. If there is no state to introduce force and coercion, changing the rules of business, putting unnecessary regulations, and tilting the playing field in favor of the corporation. When that doesn't happen, the private business always wins. The corporation will always grow to the point of where it becomes inefficient and ineffective, and it loses touch with its customer base. Unless its customer base is the state. And there we go back to road building. Okay, we'll get back to that in a minute. So then the corporation model is a socialist central plan version of the division of labor, whereas the private company utilizes the natural division of labor. The state works hand in hand with the corporation to kill every manifestation of the private company, because the private company is a threat to the corporation and to the state. Voluntarism is always a threat to the state. It's not the classification of, quote, corporation that makes the entity a part of the state. It's the behavior of the entity. The corporation moves into the trap of the state as it behaves more and more as a part of the state. Now, okay, roads and slavery. The state loves road building because it's such a lucrative way to make money. It moves the money out of the pockets of the productive class and into the pockets of the political class. The state myths about roads are so deeply embedded, and the need for roads is so obvious that few question the expenditures, no matter how ridiculously huge they become. We have learned to ignore the constant road construction near us, as we believe it must be better somewhere else. But if you drive, and for anyone who is a truck driver or knows a truck driver, talk to them about this. As you drive from city to city within the U.S., what you're going to find is every time you enter that outer loop of freeways to begin to come into a city, you find construction after construction after construction, and it never changes year after year after year. That construction is still going on. It never completes. The same bridge project will go on over and over and over, and by the time they get it done, it's time to start all over again because the bridge is only designed to last about 20 years anyway. So by the time they get it done, it's already time to tear it down and build another one. Now really? I mean, think about this. Does a bridge have to fall apart after that set time of years? Because there are bridges in the world that are thousands of years old and never fell. And there are some pretty smart people in the world who can design some pretty amazing stuff. But once they get to work for the state, there is no motive, there is no incentive to build a bridge that'll last 500 years. The incentive is to build everything temporary so that the construction company of the politician's uncle or the construction company that the politician's top supporter owns, those construction companies, I shouldn't even say companies, they're corporations, we're back to that again. Those corporations feed money back to the politician as the politician feeds money through the form of contracts back into those road building corporations. So it's a continuous loop that cannot be stopped by some crazy engineer who designs a 500-year bridge. It's just not going to happen. They can't allow that to happen. So how are these people slaves then who build the roads and who work in the companies? Well, keep Nozak's description above in mind. And remember that a happy slave is still a slave. I want you to consider something when we're talking about road building. Consider one of the biggest U.S.-based labor projects that the state ever got involved in. That was the building of Hoover Dam. Now, if the economy would have been going good, and well, let's just take, for instance, jumping your way back machine to the middle of the roaring 20s when the economy was great and everybody was employed and everything was doing well. Do you think that if it would have become a pet project of the president at that time to go out into the middle of the desert and pay just barely wages that you could just barely eat and live by, in the middle of the desert, under horrific living conditions that are almost indescribably bad, to build this giant dam under horribly dangerous circumstances where a lot of people died building that dam, under circumstances that would never be tolerated today in our more modern workforce. But there, that's the way it was, building that dam. People died, people got encased into the dam, and that's just the way it happened. Would, under good labor circumstances, under a strong economy, would the government have been able to offer just dirt low wages under horrible working conditions for people to leave their families and go out into the middle of the desert in 110, 120 degree weather and pound away at the rocks and build the Hoover Dam? Who would have done that? Who would have done that if you could work for Ford for a good living, be able to afford a home and afford a new car and all those things? Who would have left their job at a steel factory in Pittsburgh where you're supporting your family and you're living happily and you're able to actually increase your position on a regular basis? Who would leave that and go to the middle of the Nevada desert? Well, it's not really the middle. It's more like the edge. But anyway, to the Nevada desert, to work under those circumstances. And now we're talking about slavery. How is it that working on the Hoover Dam in, say, 1932, where literally people are dying all around you in the heat and because of the bad living conditions and because of the horrific working conditions that they were under, how is that any different than the slaves that built the pyramids in Egypt? Well, there's one difference. The Hoover Dam actually did something. So, you know, you could sell that to the American public who are paying the taxes to support it, probably a lot easier than you could sell the idea of a pyramid, who it's just going to function to encase the king at some point in the future. But then again, we go back to Nozak's levels of slavery. So one level of slavery will go out and build a pyramid without any questioning as to why it has to be built, simply because they have no choice. But a different generation of slaves may need some other motivation to build the Hoover Dam or a pyramid. But then again, they're not the ones paying for it. They're just the ones doing the labor. So you have to convince the people who are paying for it that it's necessary. And it might be a little difficult to convince people in the late 1920s, early 1930s, that you needed a massive pyramid in the Nevada desert. But it could be that if you had the right circumstances where farming was suffering tremendously and where this new modern convenience of electricity was the latest thing and it was improving life in every way, and if you could convince your other working slaves that their money is going for something good. You remember we talked about how two wrongs don't make a right and how using the excuse that the ultimate goal of something is good and therefore it must be good. Or in other words, sticking a gun to someone's head and robbing them and then taking all that money and going and giving it to the poor or feeding the hungry. These concepts of wrong making right are very deceptive and very easy to latch onto and believe, but they're wrong. They're morally wrong. It's based on those principles that we talked about. It's wrong to rob, even if your ultimate destination is to do something good with the money that you robbed. So as sweet as the honey was of, hey, let's go out into the desert and build this Hoover Dam, the fact was people were being robbed to do that. So could the net result ever be good? Well, when you consider what I mentioned a minute ago, who would have gone out to the desert and done this if the economy was strong? Not very many. So what do we have to do? We have to create an environment where working in the Nevada desert in 115 degree weather with no housing and the constant threat of death and disease is preferred to, say, working on a farm. How are you going to do that? Well, you get every farm dependent upon credit, and then you crush the credit market and confiscate the farms. Now the farmers and their families are unemployed. And you also destroy the economy so that they have no choice. And then you offer them state work to feed their families. And that's not slavery? I believe it is. I believe it's the same slavery that built the pyramids, just with a twist. You see, the state is like a hill of ants. Each individual member of a hill of ants is really, really limited on its intelligence. It has no idea where the hill of ants is going, what it's doing, how it functions. It knows none of those things. The individual ant only knows its job. It goes out, it scouts, it finds food, it sends out the signals, it draws, it leaves a trail of little smelly things. I can't remember what they're called. Anyway, it leaves a little trail for the other ants to follow, and then it leads the other ants back to that food. And then it goes out and scouts more food. That's all he knows. He never questions anything beyond that. The other ant gets the message, hey, there's food that's been found. I go, I follow the trail, I get the food, I bring it back to the hill. That's all I know. When there's another trail that's spotted, when there's more food that's found, I go and I do this. And that's all I know. And deep inside the hill of ants, another ant says, I don't have any idea where this food comes from, but they bring it here. So I bring it down into the hill. We process it. We feed part of it to the queen. We feed part of it to the queen's eggs. And we set the rest up for all of us to eat. That's all I know. I don't know anything. But within the hill, within the whole body, within this giant entity, lies a greater intelligence than any single ant holds. And so this whole entity moves and acts and thinks as one, even though one individual ant has no intelligence at all to understand what it's doing. And so this anthill moves slowly from one place to another. And part of it moves into a house and invades that house. And at some point, it gets done with whatever it's going to do in that house, and it leaves that house, and it moves on to another place. And it invades a tree, or it invades somewhere where there's a collection of seeds of some kind. And each time the hill itself moves as an intelligent entity, transporting itself to where there's more food or better opportunities. But no one individual ant, not even the queen ant. The queen ant has no more intelligence than any of the other ants. She doesn't direct their activities. She's just a figurehead, like a president. She doesn't actually know anything that's going on. She's just as stupid as the rest of the ants. But the entity itself understands and thinks and moves the hill from one place to the other, completely without explanation. And this is how the state functions. The state decides to destroy the economy, and the state decides to push those people out into the desert to build a dam, and the state decides to build roads and strengthen itself through the process of this. Now, let's go back. I kind of got off the track there, but let's get back to legitimate companies and corporations, legitimate companies being privately owned companies. I already said that the state is threatened by private companies, because the private companies are pictures of a free economy, the natural division of labor that takes place in small companies, the more efficient way that they function. So the state then has to favor corporations, and among corporations, the state picks out corporations that have more of a tendency to work with the state instead of independently or instead of against the state. So as the state prefers one corporation over the other, the state brings about a condition where one corporation is more successful than another. And so the non-cooperative corporations begin to die off, and the private companies begin to die off. Soon, only state-favored corporations exist in a particular sector, and corporate socialism causes the collapse of that aspect of the economy. That sector of the economy will collapse because legitimate companies have been driven out, and non-cooperative corporations have been driven out, and only state-authorized corporations are functioning in that segment of the economy, and so that segment of the economy collapses. The corporations are then blamed, and the state tells us it must move in to save us from capitalism. Of course, there was no capitalism. That's beside the point. This process repeats itself throughout the entire economy until the state controls every aspect of the economy. Now, again, what we're talking about is the move towards socialism, because the state is socialism. And a lot of people don't recognize that all states are actually functioning under the terms of socialism, even if it doesn't call itself socialism. That's what the state's function is in that direction. So socialism is not something that's economically viable. Once socialism eliminates all aspects of the free market, socialism collapses. So then the state is doomed to collapse, as I've said probably 1,000 times in the last year. So then we see that the state's highway labor, through manipulation of the economy, through manipulation of the workforce, through manipulation of corporations, and the destruction of private companies, state highway labor, just like that Hoover Dam labor, just like the pyramids, is slave labor. And corporate labor, even though we may be happy slaves earning a good corporate living, it's still slavery. You can't get out of it. You can't leave the system. As long as you're in the system, it creates levels and levels where it's very, very difficult to get out of the system. And even if you could get out of one corporate position and get to another corporate position, all you're doing is just shifting your position among the slaves. It's not like you can leave. Ultimately, if you try to leave any of these systems, they'll drag you back in. And if you decide geographically you're going to leave the nation state that you're in, you're going to have permission for that to be accomplished. You can't just leave. You can't just go. If you live in the United States, you can't just decide one day, hey, I think I want to move to Mexico. You can't do that without permission. And you certainly can't, well, you can, but that's called black markets. And we know where I stand on black markets. And that's the difference between the slave and the free man. You see, every black market is the opposite of slavery. And every person who is bound into the corporate system is bound by slavery. So when we ultimately get to that position where the state controls all the economy, there'll still be that underneath black market in labor, black market in goods, black market in services. And so when the state's economy collapses and all the slaves fall with it, there's still going to be a segment of the population which is free. And that's where we have to prepare. That's where we have to see in what way can we find a way to make a living outside of that slave process, so that when the slave process dies, we can continue and we can go on. And I don't have the exact answer for that, because every individual, it's just like what I was talking about, the division of labor. Every individual has individual talents, individual strengths and weaknesses, individual desires, individual interests. And so to develop those in a free market, in an underground market, so that whatever the state may do, you can still continue with your talents and your abilities and find a way to make a living outside of that system. And the more of us that do this, the weaker that system will become. And the more of us that are dependent upon ourselves instead of the state or instead of the corporate structure, the stronger we all are together. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. and thank you for listening. BadQuaker.com audio article for Friday, August 26th, 2011 by Ben Stone. Rent Seeking and Wealth Destruction. There are words and phrases used by economists that can be confusing. Bad economists can intentionally use confusing words for the purpose of deception while covering the crimes of banks and governments. For example, an economist may say something like, "We need a degree of quantitative easing to jumpstart the economy and prevent price stagnation." Or perhaps he says, "Deposit multiplication is a legitimate function of the banking system." These statements can be compared to the charlatan spiritualist telling you that the dirty money in your bank account is preventing your long-dead relative from blessing you with the wisdom of heaven. Of course, transferring the dirty money to the spiritualist can solve the problem. So, no matter the profession of the charlatan, the theft occurs and is covered by the sweet words of deceit. That said, there are good economists that can be confusing as well. Not because the economist is attempting to deceive, but because the economist is using an older, more accurate word or meaning than its current, more common usage. An example could be where the economist is referring to the medieval practice of denying true land ownership to the peasant class by the privileged gentry. In modern terms, most people would call this property tax, but the good economist would more accurately call it quitrent. An equally confusing phrase could be rent-seeking. Twisted by today's common vernacular, a person could think this phrase has something to do with a landlord trying to fill a vacant apartment, but actually the meaning is quite different. The simplest definition of rent-seeking is the expenditure of resources for the purpose of enriching oneself at the expense of another without adding goods or services into the economy. This is slightly different than outright theft, which simply transfers wealth from one to another. Rent seeking actually destroys wealth while enriching one person at the expense of the other. An example of rent seeking could look something like this. A crime gang moves into an area. Two representatives of the crime gang begin visiting the local bars and taverns. In the weeks that follow, they observe the activities and the patronage of various night spots around town. On a busy Saturday evening, the owner of Willie's Blues Connection, the most popular tavern in town, walks into his office to find the gang members waiting for him. They explain to the tavern owner that, for a slight charge each week, they will offer their protection and assure that nothing unusual happens to his tavern. All too clear is the implication, so the tavern owner agrees, and the gang members take a cool 1% of the gross sales at Willie's Blues Connection. This type of extortion is called rent-seeking because the gang invested expenses, time, and energy to investigate and set up the victim. The gang members used resources as they traveled around town, familiarizing themselves with the local bars. And with time, the gang invests more resources to support the two members who maintain the gang's income flow from Willie's while they seek other suitable businesses to include in their protection racket. Perhaps a simpler version of rent-seeking could look more like this. A law firm employs two staffers who spend their days surfing the internet using keyword searches. Their purpose is to find small to medium-sized businesses, blogs, and forums that are using images, sounds, or other material that may or may not be covered by so-called intellectual property or IP laws. The law firm will use any of several means to claim ownership of the IP and then threaten to sue the user unless a fee is paid. Since such lawsuits can easily cost a small business $1 million or more to defend against, they negotiate a settlement of several thousand dollars rather than fight the law firm. This is rent-seeking because as in the gangster example above, the law firm has to maintain the employment of the thugs and invest in the ongoing expenses of finding and obtaining the IP rights in order to collect the funds rightfully earned by others. And like the gangsters above, the law firm adds nothing to the economy, so the result is an overall loss. In both cases, the key element is that the gang and the law firm are a net loss to the economy as a whole. Even though the gang and the law firm are enriched, overall the result is a drain on the economy as productive dollars are wasted in the process of the rent seeking. This, as opposed to a simple robbery where there is no net loss to the economy when the wealth is simply transferred from the victim to the thief. One last example of rent seeking. There are two companies that raise and sell rabbits. Linda's Loving Bunnies is a small operation run by a 16-year-old girl in her spare time. She hand-raises rabbits for pet stores and has been in business for 2 years, turning a net profit of $86 for the first year, followed by $237 the second year. She's building a reputation with the pet stores for supplying healthy rabbits well-adjusted to handling by humans. In other words, her bunnies don't bite. Linda, with the help of her parents, is planning to expand her business with hopes that someday it might be big enough to pay for her college education. On the other side of the county, Dev Meat Incorporated is a meat supplier for the cat food industry. They use high-intensity methods to raise rabbits for meat production, and as a side, they sell their older breeder rabbits to the pet stores once they fall off on their production quotas. These breeder rabbits tend to be somewhat less friendly than is desired by the pet stores. The regional sales manager at DevMeat notices his local sales are steadily falling each month as the pet stores prefer Linda's Loving Bunnies to his product. For no reason whatsoever, he calls his friend at the local office of the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA, and they plan a day golfing at the local club with several company attorneys and an accountant. Later that month, Linda's Loving Bunnies is visited by a USDA inspector who finds her in violation of an obscure regulation regarding cage design. One thing leads to another, and Linda and her parents are looking at a $90,000 fine for their business that has never made more than $30 in any 1 month. To be fair, Dev Meat is inspected the same day and is fined $26,000 for violations similar to those found at Linda's. The reason the fine is so much smaller is because Dev Meat was able to put a team on the problem and fix it on the spot, whereas Linda couldn't afford to replace all of her cages and associated supplies within the time given by the USDA. This is rent-seeking in the sense that DevMeat is willing to lose money in the short run in order to monopolize the rabbit market for the long-term goal of continued domination. While at the same time, this is rent-seeking on the part of the USDA, since they are simply acting in the exact same role as the gangsters in the first example and the goon lawyers in the second example. The immorality of rent-seeking should be more than obvious to the reader, but for the purpose of clarity, I should explain why it violates the zero-aggression principle. Rent-seeking, on any level, and committed by any person or persons, can only function by using either aggression, the threat of aggression, or fraud upon the property of others. Without the implied threat, the tavern owner would laugh at the gang member's request. Without the threat of the fist of the state, IP laws would be unenforceable, and they are purely the product of the state. And, finally, without the fist of the state, the private rabbit producer would outperform the corporation on the niche level and eventually grow to threaten them on the wider scale. This brings up the impact of rent-seeking on the economy as a whole. Each time a person or a group engages in rent-seeking, they reduce the overall wealth available to all of us in two ways. First, their act of rent-seeking uses resources from the economy that they do not replace through their own production. And second, the victim of the rent-seeking will use resources in defensive ways that would otherwise be available for production and commerce. When you consider that gangs and other criminals working outside the law are limited as to the kinds of businesses they can extort, how many businesses they can extort, and how much money they can extort without killing the business, it becomes clear that the outlaw element has a minor impact on the economy. However, when you consider that the state faces no limit on what kind of victims, how many victims, or the degree of extortion applied to each victim, and then you multiply that by the mind-boggling numbers of state actors employed for the sole purpose of rent-seeking, the good economist is overwhelmed at the massive amount of wealth destroyed on a daily basis. Reversing one's thoughts and considering the potential condition of the economy if state-sponsored rent-seeking were recognized for what it is and consistently condemned by the general public in the same manner that we condemn gang-sponsored extortion, a whole new world of wealth and production would pour into the economy, stimulating savings, investment, innovation, and invention. Thinking of the amazing accomplishments of the market in the last 150 years, and then extracting the impact of state-sponsored rent-seeking during that time is enough to bring a hardened man to tears at the thought of the world that could have been. At this point in the discussion, polite words fail me as I contemplate the evil beast that has consumed more wealth in the last century than has existed throughout most of human history combined. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.